So before I start reading my paper, I just decided to short notice to, given that this was made possible by the Museum of Modern Art in Warsaw, and under the impression, I think some of you have been following also some of the events in the past days, and last night we had Jihan Altari speaking, Kiluranji, Kia Henda, Greg Tate, on Don Cherry, and this recalled that many of these themes in Greg Tate's case, the musician Don Cherry, in a work from the Authorless Group, Jihan's filmic work on the liberation movements from South Africa via Angola, Cuba, to Egypt and elsewhere, as well as Kiluanji's photographic work, which has entered the collection of the museum after an exhibition that was taking place here long before we started, or 3 years before we started this Kanonfragen project, but which really somehow is one of the nucleuses, at least from my own perspective, in terms of the a certain way of doing cartographies and practicing collaborations today that deal with networks of solidarity and forgotten or somehow buried histories. So this exhibition, after it took place here at the house, where one of the key ideas often of these exhibitions is to juxtapose one historical framework with another, and this is very simple in this case because of the Cold War frame in which we are here, in this piece of frontier architecture that is meant to symbolize in its core this ideology of the Free West. The frame that were to be juxtaposed here was the Iron Curtain with the Color Curtain. The post-war reconstruction of German society, of Europe, and its terms with the reconstruction of post-colonial societies insofar as one can speak of a post-colonial. This was an exhibition that was trying to bring these, also it started a kind of constant presence of magazine of undigging magazines as one of the key platforms through which one can reconstruct details, elements of the art historical transnational canon, in this case one of the vitrines devoted to early Pan-African congresses and publications. And the book for that exhibition was also made possible by the Museum of Modern Art in Warsaw, where the exhibition went. This is an installation photograph of the Berlin iteration, and that is one where you see the work of John Acomfra in the museum in Warsaw. Okay, I'm going to my paper. And here you see an installation shot, obviously, of the already introduced exhibition that provides the larger frame of our gathering. A museum for a nation under siege and in exile. This is an exemplary project of projective canon formation. It is in the relative void in conditions of insecurity that the fundaments and resources, the thoughts and the references, and the human relationships that make up the fabric of culture come to the fore. In the always fraught normativity of centered power and the social order it affords, they instead remain hidden or comfortably appear as aesthetic surplus for enjoyment. But they do not make the ground move, nor seriously challenge or undercut mechanisms of power. In this program called Kanonfragen, we wanted to talk about the canon by looking at it against the foil of historical danger on unstable grounds. And histories of colonialism and exile create such a void on which culture needs to be reasserted, is a matter of survival and resistance. The museum that was thus projected by the International Art Exhibition for Palestine in Beirut 1978, was to be repatriated to Palestine in the indeterminate future to form the seats of a future national art museum. History is always in need of construction, and perhaps this is nowhere as visible as in the case of contested nationalities. A canon in the arts does not always work as an instrument of institutional power, a seat of ideologies and their legitimization and normalization only. Ungrounded by a field of historical contestation and faced with the dangers of the destruction of memory and meaning as such perhaps, a canon becomes indispensable for the formation of historical consciousness and provides a shared ground, like a language that connects across boundaries. The question is always what this language makes speakable and what perhaps it also renders unspeakable. So these are such thoughts inform this project, Kanonfragen, here at the HKW. And the overarching project consisted of a series of smaller and larger exhibitions and publication projects that read 20th century art history against the grain in order to connect back to the living grounds of art production and position art in a productive friction with political histories and its own conditions of possibility. Past disquiet, narratives and ghosts from the International Art Exhibition for Palestine 1978, curated by Christine and Rasha, was the inaugural exhibition of this program. An ongoing research project, the exhibition was revised and expanded in each edition, and to trace the entire trajectory, they would need hours to speak up here. The reconstructed story of the core exhibition has uncovered an intricate network and shared history of politically engaged artists and initiatives and revealed a scarcely documented history of grassroots artists' collectives in cities like Paris, Rome, Tokyo, artists' unions in Damascus, Baghdad, Casablanca, Berlin, Warsaw, and elsewhere. The project revisited also seminal editions of biennials, not only in Venice, but also Baghdad and Rabat, and museums in exile, about which we will hear more later. I'm switching now to the larger Kanonfragen frame, a bit on a meta level to share some thoughts on the exhibition making within this, and the various thematic strands. So we have, since 2016, pursued three lines of inquiry under the umbrella of this project. The first one is the one that we're gathering around here today, counter-mappings and alternative narratives of the history of art along liberation movements, resistance, and networks of solidarity, taking into account larger geopolitical contexts that haunt the global imaginary of transnational futures. Within this first line of inquiry, there was another project co-curated by Rasha Salti together with Koyoku, Saving Bruce Lee, African and Arab Cinema in the Era of Soviet Cultural Diplomacy in 2018, Bodies of Fact from Archive. The Archive from Witness to Voice by Denise Reiner, also in the same year, 2018, right up to the project that takes place right now in the foyer Afrosonic Mapping, Tracing Oral Histories via Sonic Transmigrations by Sach Hoyts and curated by Paz Guevara. And the second focus that produced large-scale exhibitions such as Parapolitics, Cultural Freedom and the Cold War in 2017, showing a few images here. And we certainly owe a lot of inspiration and historical detail, among others, from the writings of Catherine Dossin. I might return, if I have the time later, to tell you a bit about that exhibition, which is really not so much about networks of solidarity and resistance, but about the use of an autonomous art, of the freedom of art, exactly along the lines that was sketched out by Catherine earlier as part of the US-run Cultural Cold War, driven by an organization that has close ties with this building, historically the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which ran over 45 magazines really all over the world except within Soviet and Chinese dominated territories, where this form of autonomous culture of apolitical culture, a symbol of free West intellectualism, was promoted. Among them were stunning magazines, and this is one of them, Black Orpheus from Nigeria. An exhibition that also dealt with post-war reconstruction, again, really concretely on terms of what has happened after, you know, the degenerate art exhibition and the destruction of modernism, of the avant-garde's through fascism, through Nazism, and tracing this, you know, back to the 1930s, particularly these kind of pivotal moments like the Paris exhibition in 1937, Cubism and Abstract Art in 1937, and Arte der Kunst in 1937. And again, in Parapolitics, Richard writes, the color curtain appears, only that here we add a level of ambivalence to the story, because it was in fact said Congress for Cultural Freedom who had financed Richard Wright's journey to Bandung, which is what this book speaks about, the 1955 Bandung conference, that is a certain inaugural moment of third world solidarity, in some cases short-lived, in others not. And we juxtaposed that very ambivalent frame of one of the most esteemed Afro-American novelists being implicated in the Cultural Cold War by the U.S. in rather tragic dimensions that also, again, the Otterlith Group has worked on for years and contributed to this Parapolitics exhibition, with the very problem that the Congress for Cultural Freedom back then was confronted with, communicating racial discrimination within the U.S. Towards the outside world. And here just one of the key works that was about this form of juxtaposing incommensurable frameworks, how Adela Pindell's Free, White, and 21 video work from 1980. Second large-scale exhibition, Neolithic Childhood, Art in a False Present, circa 1930, from 2018, focused on I'm going to get to Neolithic Childhood later. Both of these exhibitions focused on renewing a revisionist approach to the history of modernism, and again, drawing on more recent work, such as Catherine Dossin's or Andrea Giunta's and several others, they brought to the light aspects of the canon that have historically been covered up or sunken into relative obscurity, of course not without a vast amount of critical literature trying to do the archaeology of exactly that which had sunken into oblivion. But what I'm, in a nutshell, think these exhibitions were doing with modernism rather than with the historiography of resistant movements and networks of solidarity, etc., was trying to emphasize that modernism in its origin, among other things, was crucially a rebellion against the bourgeois enclosure of art, its economization and institutionalization from the late 19th century onwards. It was a search for a radical heteronomy and for collective transformation before it became classical modernism, particularly here in this country, and was pacified under the yoke of formalism and autonomy in the later part of the century. And the third line of inquiry now explores some of the consequences of such a renewed approach to a revisionist art history, which I would call an unlimiting or debordering of art history against that very enclosure of it as a disciplined institution, and problematizing this very institutionalized category of modern art. And that was definitely what Neolithic childhood was mainly about, and that's why Neolithic childhood, through the figure of Karl Einstein, who kind of wrote the first canonization of modernism when it was still in swing in 1926, in his book The Art of the 20th Century. Contextualizing Einstein and his early writings on African sculpture and his later writings from the 1930s, in which he envisioned a vast anthropology of art as the only way out of this embourgeoisification. Karl Einstein was providing us with the matrix for this exhibition, co-curated by Tom Hollert, that was about this desperate need to look for other resources for the arts, and how this quest was in a kind of entering into this unholy alliance with a reinscription of, you know, racialized patterns of primitivism, of often explicitly seeking to overcome, but still caught and fraught within it. And secondly, also, it was an exhibition about a kind of missed encounter and about the structural, perhaps, conditions of this missed encounter, namely between that European avant-garde gathering, say, around the magazine Document, of which Karl Einstein was co-editor with Georges Bataille and others in the late 20s and early 30s, with anti-colonial thinkers and protagonists of the black radical tradition and of the Negritude movement, inhabiting the same cultural space at that time, often in Paris, in Berlin, in New York to a certain degree. And yet being, to a degree that is not often talked about, completely not talking to each other, or the former not being receptive to the latter, with few exceptions. The exhibitions Love and Ethnology, The Colonial Dialectics of Sensitivity After Hubert Fichte, and Spectral White, The Appearance of Colonial Era Europeans, that are running right now, are projects that dealt with what the category of the modern has excluded and foreclosed and relegated to disciplines other than art, such as anthropology, but also psychology, media theory, and others. So in a way, you know, these two exhibitions are consciously problematic because they both take German figures as starting point, but this is out of a belief that there is a certain necessity for each locale to deal with its own genealogies, specters, ghosts, and in this case, they are figures that for what we have available in a German-speaking canon, they definitely belong to an anti-racist, anti-fascist, and politically advanced and radical canon. So that's to subject them to a rereading, figures such as Julius Lips, working in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, Hubert Fichte, coming out of you know, a childhood in an orphanage hidden from the Nazis, gay or bi, exploring Afro-diasporic religions after having done a kind of ethnography of subcultures and the margins of society within Hamburg first. Connecting them to a critical rereading today is really about trying to connect discourses, to bring them, to make them talk to each other, and to listen to the cracks that appear when, for instance, you map a far advanced discourse such as critical race studies, but largely operating within an Anglo-American paradigm, onto the discourses available historically here right now. No? So these were basically the motives behind that. But beyond these figures, these exhibitions are also and especially, perhaps, projects about transforming cosmologies, about the actual histories of entanglement and transculturation that are the products of survival and regeneration. And here the difficult montage is, again, that of reconstruction of European society out of the rubble of Nazism and Second World War, with, in the case of Love and Ethnology, the counter-canon of Afro-diasporic cosmologies. And Love and Ethnology, you know, Hubert Fichte, to just spend a few more words on him, was engaged in this rather ambitious, I mean, like Karl Einstein, he had his own project of re-narrating the canon, and it is actually, he didn't manage to complete it. It was meant to be called The History of Sensitivity, and meant to be for his time what the Recherche of Proust was for his, but now made to the measure of the world, not only to bourgeois European subjectivity. Hubert Fichte's unfinished literary re-narration of the canon was interestingly also based on the assertion of African cultural presence in Greek antiquity and on tracing the whitening of that history, drawing on Herodot, perhaps, we don't know, Sheikh Anta Diop, and prefiguring Martin Bernal's Black Athena. Perhaps, you know, not unlike what Serge Hoyt yesterday said here on stage about his project, that one of the core concepts that pursued by him was you know, departing around this knowledge of what he calls the Africanization of Christianity. This Fichte project is also pretty much about a similar you know, historiographical shift. Described in the catalog, in particular by Erhard Schüttpelz in the essay, who, following Sidney Mintz and Robert Faris Thompson and others, would describe the Caribbeanization of European post-war societies and, by extent, through global pop culture, the globe, in which, of course, music plays a core role, and which played for the post-war European societies, but not limited to those. Indeed, although the term is here used and in a very different form than in colonial discourse, a civilizing role. And Schüttpelz describes this journey of Fichte along the Black Atlantic as actually grappling with his own Caribbean modernization rather than looking for an archaic, what he called the African computer, meaning that which had survived in the diaspora. So these latter exhibitions also want to be contributions to a renewed engagement with an anthropology of art, a speculative anthropology of the mimetic, mnemonic, and imaginative faculties of human mythopoesis and world-making. This engagement with anthropological speculation and anthropological constants is a third line of inquiry It is, of course, impossible to do so without taking into account our situatedness and speaking positions by working through the coloniality of ethnology and anthropology under fire for their implication in colonial knowledge regimes and haunted to the core by the continuing magnitude of colonial violence, producing racialized gastes and great manufacturing great divides, such as between anything modern and pre-modern, whether openly or backhandedly, serving to consolidate a fiction of a white West. Acknowledging our situatedness, I believe, must result in bringing forth a double consciousness within these bodies of knowledge, a double consciousness that might be needed to complement the colonially inflicted double consciousness described by key thinkers of the Black radical tradition. And the exhibitions that are currently on view are trying to address themselves to that task, at producing such a double consciousness within the locus of the white gaze and awareness that the colonial frontier is reproduced and runs through every and each of us, although, of course, according to our situatedness in radically different forms. And it also means to acknowledge that we are talking from within, particularly within a camouflaged and failing liberalism that perpetuates a weaponized time geography of accelerating disaster capitalism, and from an economized compartmentalization of disciplined knowledges. There is hence no easy access to and no unproblematic knowledge of the universal or better ecumenic dimensions of imaginative human world making in its diversity and resilience. But as some of the documents and artistic reflections in the Fichte exhibition around migrating syncretic ritual practices, as well as the sonic signifier that Satch talks about, when we talk about mimetic, mnemonic, and imaginative faculties and human mythopoethics and world-making, we really do not only talk about cosmological resilience and regeneration, but equally important about a knowledge that of that which cannot be taken away, what cannot be robbed, accumulated, colonized, controlled. It can, of course, be colonized, but it persists, right? And that might be the subject proper of that's why I'm not willing to give up on anthropology. Since the critical future importance of that discipline may then lie in defending this knowledge of that which cannot be taken away and of our better potentialities, defending it from this sad camouflage and induced structural amnesia, but is also from its partition by identitarian possessions. And this is what Carl Einstein insisted on in his Better Moments, when he was writing about Paul Klee and others, the event he was tracing there was a cosmic magnitude, in the sense that of insisting on this cosmogony taking place at every moment anew, out of a foundational indeterminacy and an ever transformative real. But knowing that just what kind of cosmos, what kind of human is created, because he cherished art history for being sort of the actual domain of freedom, because in art humans actually create themselves or get in touch with these powers through which of freedom, that such self-creation, which is really radically opposed to enlightenment subject self-creation or self-birthing of the patriarchal tradition. He insisted that what kind of society is produced out of these cosmogonic forces, and this is where he differed from the Marxist canon of his time, is not only a question of economic determination, but also, crucially, of social myths, ways of seeing architectures of knowledge and stories. And such architectures, which shape our imaginary of past and future, is perhaps what a canon then is about. So when I speak of anthropology and an anthropology of art, I want you to imagine a flight into the beyond of a contemporary art that is currently being eaten alive by the global class it caters to, more or less fully integrated into what Sven Lüttigen calls the integral loop of the circuits of abbreviated capital, where they end up as culturalized commodities with disproportionately high profit margins. So I'm coming. How much time do I still have left, Paz? 20. The anthropological and ethnographic archive contains also a different story, one of reckoning with modernity and coloniality, progressive political projects born out of knowledge over ignorance, of the possibility to undo great divides and re-narrate the imperial, a counter-knowledge that systematically undercuts naturalized and fetishized divisions. This archive is equally rich and necessary for what Sylvia Winter outlined as a possible, a necessary counter-humanism, one that is not based on a category of the subhuman, but made to the measure of the world. Ecumene. Discarding this archive, we think, makes not only a reconstruction of modernity and our place in it impossible, but also results unwillingly not in a decolonial common future, but in a production of ever hardening identitarian molds. There is a counter tradition of exhibition making that I wanted to communicate with in this Kanonfragen project that is also comes also from the beginning of the 20th century and is more of a local and equally problematic history, but again, progressive for its time. And that is a form of speculative, synoptic anthropological exhibition, as it took place, among others, in the 1920s at the Folkwang Museum in Essen, following the legacy of Karl-Ernst Osthaus and some of his collaborators and successors. Back then, when the modernist avant-gardes were in close dialogue and otherwise deeply engaged with anthropological speculations, because modernism was, as I said, not least the very product of that rebellion against the bourgeois enclosure of art. It is, however, not possible to simply return to making synoptic exhibitions in which works of modern art are being juxtaposed with ethnographic artifacts, you know, the classic up to 1984 and further on. It has this format, of course, is haunted by its own impossibility already back then, of the by the realities of colonial capitalism and the modern practices of division that would turn the mere attempt into an evasion, into a typically false universality of bourgeois mythology. You know? I mean, up to, let's say, Le Magicien de Terre. It's like, what connects us is, oh, we are all spiritual. No? Like, and that is, of course, a very bourgeois escapist fantasy. Only when the very platform from which any comparison is made is radically seeking articulation of its always already mediated relationality, when its representative authority is upset, its tacit assumptions exposed, can such an agenda of an anthropologically unlimited art history be envisioned again as an institutional practice rather than as a research agenda only. Kanonfragen was a project that on the exhibition-making level works towards a conception of the exhibition space as a liminal space. And this means that you have to always kind of be conscious that, you know, what is the dominant, what's the hegemonic form of the exhibition? What does it do to exhibit something? This dominant genealogy of positivist, objectivist, and triumphalist exhibitionary practices. I mean, triumphalism in the sense of, like, you know, we can represent everything and we are centering ourselves by doing so. And so these exhibitionary practices, well analyzed by, I'm not going into detail now, in the modern colonial vein, can be undercut, and the medium of the exhibition can be conceived instead as a threshold space, where boundaries and their dialectics can be explored at the fringes of social and symbolic orders, the limits of their respective codes against the very positivist closure of meaning. It's a space that's capable then, perhaps, of opening from within the screen of internalizations and externalizations that intervenes between gaze and subject to constitute visibility. To the extent that art history could be about an anthropologically and science-theoretically unlimited art history of such a border space, its interests will be shared with that of a decolonial anthropology. I'd like to think of the kind of research practice that goes into these Kanonfragen projects, hence also in terms of a poetics, although definitely not in terms of like a kind of, you know, curatorial authorship model. No? It's really rather about making the framings, that the frameworks that are constitutive of meaning, explicit and destabilize them in the same time. And that kind of means that you plunge into the certainty of knowledge into a form of crisis, and deprive the kind of usual categories of self-evidence. And this is really what one can do in exhibitions, no? And what, anyway, art does to a large degree. Simply because you have this very strong drive the moment you enter an exhibition it gets these kind of mechanisms of identification and you want to know, what do you see, who am I in front of that thing, what is the date, the author, etc. And all these, like, this apparatus that sets in, you know, that is like a navigational tool, with introducing minor vibrations even, can produce rather great effects. The detachment, I mean, this is basically now a bit of a paragraph that leads you just a little bit into this tripping character of exhibitions. So the becoming explicit of silent background assumptions, the becoming thematic of structural conditionings of art, in and as art, is definitely characteristic of a lot of artistic practices itself, especially, you know, those that have shaped as sort of reflective practices the decades following the 1980s, institutional critique, critique of representation in new museology as well, and its destinies, no? And that have sort of been, and we have some of the artists in the exhibition here, like René Green, who have begun to short-circuit the heritage of institutional critique with the post-colonial discourse, and kind of circulate around a double crisis of a Western semiosphere and its kind of investment in its technological superiorities and others. The detachment of science from the designated, the denunciation of the embedding of our science systems into instrumental functions produces a flood of unstable, potentially transformative meanings in the perception of art along the entire possible spectrum of expression and meaning. Aesthetic experience in this unlimited form is a threshold experience in which it is not a matter of a mere variance of fixed codes, but of the possibility of remelting and transforming the code system itself. In the space of art, there is thus cartographic ambiguity, and the resulting state of dizziness can also be perhaps described in the words of anti-psychiatrist R.D. Lying as ontological uncertainty, which also points to the ambivalence of that, because this kind of opening of the sign relation has these two aspects, no? An euphoric one and a paranoid one. Who Lange used this term to describe the feeling of the loss of the categorical distinction between imagination and reality, self and outside world. But ontological uncertainty is by no means a matter of poetry in the bourgeois sense, but it remains inseparably connected with the history of violence and terror, which informs the distinction between sense, nonsense, and the making of the boundary between self and world and the subjectivities on and within the various sites along the colonial frontier. Last page. precisely because of the asociality of art, or its kind of disruptive, cosmologically disruptive form, by when it detaches instrumental sign operations, unhinges them. This, of course, produces on the curatorial level a rather major problem with any form of thematically framed exhibitions, simply because you know, the framing itself is a reifying force. It is transforming what a work of art can do in an exhibition, which is, of course, an old battle. I mean, right since the Louvre opened to become a more or less democratic place, it was hailed as the death chamber, really, of art. So this is a very old theme, but I think it has a slightly different register in which this problem articulates itself when it comes to thematic framings. There is no way out of this problem, I believe, other than kind of trying to create a kind of palimpsest, a woven tapestry, where, you know, more or less given frameworks, cultural patterns of interpretations, or even entire worldviews are mirrored and then plunged into a crisis. No? Whether this and this, like, the question of how you ground that in historical detail is deciding whether that indeterminacy that opens up in such moments of destabilization is transformed into bad generality, into flat abstractions, or affects a lasting change that is not just an additive principle on a narrative, on how you will reframe the experience once you leave the exhibition space. okay. Parallel to the past disquiet exhibition in 2016, and today is a kind of one of the last events of this Kanonfragen event, so please allow me there, hence this kind of self-referential circles. The conference that inaugurated the conference in parallel to the exhibition was called A History of Limits, which is borrowed from Foucault, who basically opened the first edition of the History of Madness, and later he changed the foreword with these lines: there could be a history of limits, but from what point can it be written, right? It has to be written from the point before the division between madness and the voice of reason. And he imagines what that place could be, this before that is actually not quite possible, but remains a necessary imaginative flight line and a point of historiographic reconstruction at the same time. And I think this is really where these kind of, you know, speculative narratives are geared towards, the relationship between these two. when you make this limits dance, what might result from it is a kind of deinstitutionalized institutional practice. I mean, this is, of course, dangerous to say, but because the institution is in the end always stronger. But that doesn't mean, I mean, I have always believed that one can change institutions from within, knowing that there is always, of course, a moment where that might also ultimately be a delusion. So a deinstitutionalized practice, exhibitionary practice, that pursues an unlimiting or debordering of art history in the opposite direction to that of the additive global expansion of the canon that Catherine Dossin has already laid out, no, where basically chapter is added and we are righting the wrongs of, yeah, it was really bad, the Eurocentrism. Let's correct our mistakes. The market also grows bigger, so it's we are teaming up with new economic forces. And in fact, the core of the narrative remains unchanged. And changing the main narrative, perhaps, you know, really begins with this sensing of the absence of what had originally been foreclosed. I mean, constitutively, you know, in the sense that when you bring something back that was excluded, it bears a force of unbelonging that cannot be just so easily pacified. And there is a strange pacification going on in a lot of world art. Global expansionism right now that is really eerie. And I'm not saying that we are not occasionally part of the problem. It's very difficult to, you know, to not fall into this strange righteousness of this righting the wrongs paradigms, of kind of representational justice that buys cheap culturalization, where, you know, an overinvestment also of liberal belief in the democratization of art as a democratizing force is also a problem within this constellation. I think these are images from the current exhibition right here, and this is some of the work Papis Du Bois murals, Collectivo Bonobando in the upper left, Tiona McLodden in the upper right, and Julius Lipp's figure. But I think I've run out of time. I wanted to basically still explain two or three elements of what in the murals in relation to syncretic ritual, what it is that remains unassimilatable to a modern expanded canon, yeah? But I think I'll leave it here, and I can do so at another occasion or in any of the guided tours that I do in the next 2 months through these exhibitions. I'll anyway talk about that. I wanted to thank all the curatorial collaborators on this project, Rasha and Christine, of course, who have contributed a great deal, Koyo Kuo, Max Jorge Hinderer, Mario Navarro, Amilcar Packer, Yasumi Omolu, Denise Reiner, Antonia Mayaka, Nida Gauss, Dietrich Diedrichsen, Tom Hollert, Kerstin Starkemeyer, David T., my fantastic team at the HKW, and of course many artists that have really, I mean, I mentioned only Jehan at the Otolith Group. There were some really great people all along with us returning here in great frequency, and it's been a great pleasure. Thanks for your patience.